This is the Voice of Freedom.
Cadets, cats, and kittens. It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. You know, I mentioned on the last episode of the show that I had nothing planned this season about UFOs, and that's been fucking bothering me ever since, if I'm being completely honest with you, but not for the reasons that you would think. So, when I conceived of this show, and those of you who've been, I again hate to say long-time listeners, but who've been listening to the show for a while, are aware that Come and See was sort of a riff on Bill Cooper's Behold a Pale Horse, and sort of conceptually based off of Bill's Mystery Babylon is kind of a jumping off point for how I wanted to structure the way that I present the material in the episodes. It's evolved from that, but that was really the core concept and why the first three episodes of the show are about Uncle Bill. They're fucking terrible, but they exist if you want to go listen to them. Anyway, it didn't occur to me at the time that in doing that, I had sort of married myself to making constant observations about ways in which I and this show are similar to Bill and the Hour of the Time. And it's one of those things that comes up frequently whenever I'm reading something, whenever I look at how I presented something, or go back and listen to his old broadcasts and realize that he covered something exactly the same way that I did. I had a really weird revelation before this show even started, whenever I still worked on the Four-Cornered Room, whenever I realized listening to several of his old broadcasts that Bill frequently used the word hep. So there's a lot of those kinds of things, and one of them that's kind of tripping the light fantastic for the kid at the moment is that, I've spent most of my youth, my adolescence, and my young adult life trying to convince people that extraterrestrials are probably a real thing, and talking about UFOs, both, you know, theoretically, hypothetically, and realistically, is a thing that I both hope exists and believe does exist, right? And here we are, for the first time probably in my lifetime, that we're having a widespread conversation about how a lot of people are pretty sure that there's extraterrestrials and there's a UFO phenomenon taking place, and I am shaking my head and saying, no, this is a government conspiracy, and in a couple of months they're going to tell us this was China. Fuck me. You know, it's a shame because I would love to experience the wonderment of, maybe they're finally here. But no, these things that are being shot down by the United States military are going to be quote unquote revealed to have been drones sent from China in a month or so to try to justify a war with the Chinese because we have a septuagenarian in office as president who still thinks that we function on a wartime economy and that total war will in some way revitalize a tanking American economy. Well done to him. But that's just a bit at the top, right? So before I get into today's subject, which I don't want to dawdle too long, before I get into, because I got a lot to cover today, holy fuck the government legislation that I had to read for this thing, I want to formally welcome and give a shout out to the newest members of the Hep cult, Steven and Justin. Welcome aboard. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate you. We'll send your complimentary gift baskets out post haste. If you, listener, would like to become a member of the Hep cult, which as you can see is ever growing and illustrious in its composition, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And for as low as the cost of a beer, you can kick $5 my way for the month, help me keep the lights on, perhaps buy groceries or dog food, any of these other essentials that, you know, keep me going in the in-between times, and that would be greatly appreciated. There's a few different tiers available there, in addition to the $5 one. I'm compiling some exclusive content for Patreon subscribers, but by way of that, is when you sign up, there is something that I worked on between season 3 and this season called the Uncle Bill tape. You heard the first track from it at the beginning of the episode, actually. It's the intro music for season 4. It's a whole bunch of Bill Cooper sound bites overlaid over some dope ass beats of a Wu-Tang nature that I just threw together as a thank you to the fans, because I've been doing this for a year now and coming up on 100 episodes, and I don't understand how that's possible. That's available to you if you sign up for the Patreon thing. There'll be other exclusive content. I'm going to be recording some stuff, actually based off of the episode today, in fact, that'll be available specifically to Patreon subscribers moving forward. And if you'd like to wear or drink your support for the Come and See podcast for whatever reason, you can do so by hitting up the merch store at comeandseemerch.bigcartel.com. We have a coffee collaboration with Black Forge Coffee Company called Behold a Dark Roast, another Bill Cooper play, you'll note. That's free trade and excellent coffee available from an excellent company that I endorse and support. Love them over there. Their aesthetic is fantastic. They host some dope shows over there as well. If you're in the Pittsburgh area, you should check them out. And they've got some other great coffees available as well, but this one's mine, so I'm going to recommend it to you most of all. I've also got a t-shirt up there that's available until I come up with another design, which I'm hoping to do before 420. So that's all the, hey, this is actually a business shit that I have to go over up top. Moving on to the content of today's show. So the last two episodes, you know, we covered sort of the cocaine fascism thing on the season premiere, and on Wednesday's episode, we talked about America's relationship to crime, and this is sort of related to both of those things, in that today we're going to talk about cannabis prohibition and drug prohibition in the United States specifically, because this is sort of a unique problem even within the larger problem of American crime, going back now like 100-some years. And there ain't no party like a drug crime party, because a drug crime party don't stop. Sorry, I spent like 4.5 days researching federal legislation on drug prohibition and got really, really, really fucking stoned before I did this. So if I tend to get a bit heavy on the jazz lingo throughout this episode, I apologize in advance. Anyway, we're looking at drug crime, how drug crime really fueled mass incarceration and the carceral state, and therefore the exploitable workforce that we discussed on Wednesday's episode, and how all of these things were really fueled by an underlying racialization from the very beginning that conflated drugs and white people's fears about marginalized groups in a way that made them easier to over-police and therefore more susceptible to becoming exploitable laborers. So there's a lot today to go over. So I'm gonna go ahead and, you know, fucking get into it. So here we go. The first therapeutic and eventually recreational form of cannabis, Cannabis indica, was first identified by Westerners in India in 1785 and named by Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. The plant was shorter and more dense than sativa and was found in the Hindu Kush mountain range. As a plant suited to grow in the mountains, the indica plant proved well suited for cultivation in temperate climates. Indica actually means of India, and cannabis taxonomy wasn't particularly important to the culture until the 70s, the 1970s, and indica became eventually just synonymous with recreational cannabis in general. Cannabis indica was first introduced to Westerners for its therapeutic potential by Irish physician William Brooke O'Shaughnessy in the 1830s. O'Shaughnessy began publishing papers on the broader medical applications of the plant while serving as a member of the Medical and Physical Society of Calcutta. He would describe and affirm Indian folk uses of the plant, as well as develop new ones, being one of the first to document cannabis's use in treating seizures, tremors, and spasms, including in children. He treated rheumatism and convulsions with much success as well. Eventually, O'Shaughnessy's reports popularized the use of cannabis in England, where he further revolutionized its medical potential, using the resin to treat rabies and tetanus muscle spasms. Cannabis was part of O'Shaughnessy's larger attempt to sort of normalize Eastern medicine and its benefits to Westerners. In addition to medical benefits from cannabis, hemp had been used for rope, clothing, and sails in the American colonies since 1606. In the 1700s, British colonies were actually required to grow it. Hemp oil was used in lamps. Hemp was a cheap paper alternative. As many of you stoners who are listening to this are probably aware, the Declaration of Independence is actually written on it. A study published by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1916 stated that hemp provides 4 times more cellulosic fiber per acre than trees. And, you know, there's that whole trees providing oxygen, so you shouldn't fucking cut them down thing, but whatever. The first attempts to regulate the recreational consumption of cannabis were the poison laws, the first of which was enacted in California, actually. Around 1860, the government began attempting to regulate the sale of pharmaceuticals. Substances believed to be adulterated or discouraged, like arsenic, but also cannabis, cannabis indica, were required to carry packaging indicating the harmful effects of the drugs or prohibiting sale outside of licensed pharmacies without a doctor's prescription. Pharmaceutical societies at the time pushed for cannabis to be included in the list of regulated poisons. In 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed, requiring that specified drugs such as alcohol, morphine, cocaine, heroin, and cannabis be accurately labeled with contents and dosage. Also known as Dr. Wiley's Law, so named for chemist and first commissioner of the FDA, Harvey Washington Wiley, who championed the act, the Pure Food and Drug Act was the first in a series of congressional consumer protection laws, which culminated in the creation of the Food and Drug Administration. The act federally mandated and maintained purity levels for all registered substances. At the root of the act was fast-paced urbanization, leading to makeshift preservatives like formaldehyde being put in food products. But it was used to piggyback a precursor for anti-drug legislation under the auspices of a public safety issue about purity levels. Recreational cannabis use in the U.S. is largely credited to the Mexican-American War and early propaganda racializing cannabis as marijuana began to appear in the U.S. around 1910. We'll talk about that more later. Previous to its conflation with Mexicans, British colonists and slave owners in both the United States and Jamaica actually imported the plant and used it to pacify slaves. Slaves in cotton and sugarcane fields were encouraged to smoke the plant as it kept them, as per the slave owners, relatively docile yet productive. It was sold and taxed by the East India Company, as a matter of fact. Gradually through its use by slaves in the Americas and in Jamaica, cannabis began to be viewed, up until the Mexican-American War introduced it more broadly, as a non-white drug. Brought in smokable form by Mexican revolutionaries via networks called marijuaneros, growers, weed smoking amongst whites in America first emerged, we think, in Texas, actually, where the first city ordinance against it was passed in 1914. Even after these introductions were made, American perception and propaganda continued to present cannabis as a colored people's drug until the 1960s and its eventual conflation with college-age white liberal hippies by the Nixon administration. Post-slavery, sailors supplied black people in places like New Orleans, reassociating its use with black culture post-slavery. This identification of cannabis as something only non-white people did would play a huge part in its institutional demonization. With the Pure Food and Drug Act, cannabis was grouped with substances like opium, alcohol, and morphine as of a particularly addictive nature, and products containing it were required to identify themselves as dangerous and highly addictive. Goods found in violation of the act were subject to seizure and destruction. If they were not submitted for inspection by a panel of inspectors, also authorized by the act. Shortly thereafter, Massachusetts became the first state to fully legalize cannabis in 1911, following a series of statutes and ordinances intended to discourage its use. The American Medical Association established a propaganda department in 1913, dubbed the Propaganda for Reform Department. They didn't even try to fucking hide it. It was overseen by Dr. Arthur J. Cramp, who had opposed the Pure Food and Drug Act in favor of even stricter legislation. Cramp produced a 3-volume series called Nostrums and Quackery that debunked what he called quackery, everything from tapeworm weight loss to freckle removal skin creams. And as director of the propaganda office, he kept a file of fake products submitted for test and trial based on testimonials from American physicians. Products that didn't pass regulation were published in a notice of judgment list maintained by what would become the FDA. By the 1920s, Wiley's FDA would serve as the federal regulating body of all food, drugs, biological products, cosmetics, tobacco, medical, and radiation-emitting devices. Part of this was a fairly bitter struggle between federal regulators and the manufacturers of what were called patent medicines, which were a precursor to over-the-counter medicines. Things like sedatives, laxatives, antiseptics, cough medicines, and analgesics, among other things. These patent medicines were unregulated and often didn't disclose their ingredients, and they were also often marketed as things like tonics, elixirs, or liniments. Many of these were predominantly alcohol-based and produced at best questionable results. But patent medicines were one of the first major product categories promoted by the advertising industry, who had something of a chokehold on print media at the time. So products like soothing syrups and opium-based teething medicine for infants dominated smaller newspapers, which depended on money from the advertising companies. Many papers had what were known as red clauses in their contracts that stated ad funds would be withdrawn if the paper expressed support for food and drug regulations. As for the products themselves, many liniments purported themselves to contain actual snake oil. This is the origin of the snake oil salesman canard. Products advertised as crafted by noble savages, fake doctors, endorsed by celebrities, Indian root pills, the fucking electric fez, even pills with trace amounts of uranium. And this sounds ridiculous until you think about the paleo diet or Gwyneth Paltrow's yoni stones. People have been selling bullshit disguised as medicine for centuries. In actuality, the active ingredients in most of these products were narcotics. Grain alcohol, like I mentioned earlier, but also cocaine, opium, and morphine. Things the federal government was growing keen to keep an eye on the sale of, and as more states adopted dry laws prohibiting alcohol, these patent medicines were providing easy access to liquor. Interestingly, the original formula for Coca-Cola fell under the umbrella of patent medicines, as it contained coca extract, hence the name, before substituting it for caffeine. It's sort of funny that someone felt that a fair and balanced substitute for cocaine was caffeine. That should probably say something. Anyway, the original get up and go in Coke was Coke. Medicines marketed as cures for female complaints were tested and determined to be essentially opium and grain alcohol. No wonder the fucking divorce rate was so low. Unfortunately, so was the average life expectancy. Fortunately, one such patent medicine advertised itself as able to restore life in the event of sudden death. So, they had you covered. Despite claims of being able to cure death, and a lot of these medicines, killing people. Incidentally, unregulated doses of opium aren't good for teething infants. And as more journalists, independent of newspapers, who were known as muckrakers, began reporting on the deaths and addictions being caused by the patent medicine industry, the federal government began pressuring these markets to begin placing warning labels and disclaimers on all of their products, hoping to discourage their use. Once regulations began to limit their sale, the products themselves went into decline, especially as newspapers began being purchased by people like William Randolph Hearst. Oh, he'll come up later. Deficiencies perceived in the Pure Food and Drug Act led to the passage of the Harrison Act in 1914. With the Harrison Act, federal drug prohibition as we would recognize it today really began to take shape. The Harrison Narcotics Tax Act regulated and taxed the production, importation, and distribution of opiates and coca products. The full title of the act, an act to provide for the registration with collectors of internal revenue, and to impose a special tax on those who produce, import, manufacture, compound, deal in, dispense, sell, distribute, or give away opium or coca leaves, their salts, derivatives, or preparations, and for other purposes. The "for other purposes" part, I think, gives more than a slight indication of its purposes. Untaxed narcotics were really a problem for the federal government. Not giving the government a cut is always a problem for the government. So now, selling narcotics was a problem for the people. This at first raised questions about, you know, violating the Fifth Amendment and a right to a fair trial before presumption of guilt. Vice crimes subjected to punitive measures required no trial. This would be the first of many constitutional rights circumvented in the name of drug prohibition. By the time the Harrison Act was passed, distribution and use of cocaine was technically illegal, except for registered companies and individuals. This further restricted its sale. Before the Harrison Act, you could actually buy syringes of cocaine in the Sears and Roebuck for $1.50. Home delivery. Absolutely fucking gonzo. Opium use had really proliferated in the Philippines during the Spanish-American and Philippine-American wars. Use spread even further after a cholera outbreak in 1902, during which opium was used for its astringent properties. The church was really stirring about opposition to opium on moral grounds by the beginning of the 20th century and had pressured President William Taft to move on opium restrictions by the time he took office. And while Taft supported opium restrictions, the Department of State initially balked at the interference with private business. But with an understanding that narcotics could instead be taxed for revenue, regulation was easier to swallow. In 1912, an international opium convention was held at The Hague, which resulted in the first international drug control treaty, League of Nations. Sorry, the League of Nations was sort of a precursor to the UN, and it continued to oversee international prohibition until the end of the Second World War, when international heroin traffic began to be facilitated by the CIA. At the beginning of the 20th century, medical journals began reporting on the effects that cocaine was having on Southern Negroes. According to the Journal of the American Medical Association, quote, "Negroes in the South are reported as being addicted to a new form of vice, that of cocaine sniffing, or the cocaine habit." End quote. Propaganda indicating cocaine made black men rape white women and shoot pistols better propagated middle-class white circles. And at the same time, opium was linked to a problem stemming from Chinese immigration. One drug prohibition committee, the Committee on the Acquirement of the Drug Habit, went so far as to say, quote, "If the Chinaman cannot get along without his dope, we can get along without him." End quote. You'll remember from Wednesday that this coincided with the driving out period, when Chinese immigrant laborers were targeted as a threat to white labor. Suddenly, opium was a problem, and it got here from China. A strategy that the U.S. would never use again all the time. A report by the New York Times in 1911 declared that, quote, "Of all the nations in the world, the United States consumes the most habit-forming drugs per capita, with opium, the most pernicious drug known to humanity, is surrounded in this country with far fewer safeguards than any other nation fences it with." End quote. The same piece equates cocaine and rape, saying, quote, "It has been authoritatively stated that cocaine is often the direct incentive to the crime of rape by the Negroes of the South and other parts of the country," end quote, and that, quote, "One of the most unfortunate phases of smoking opium in this country is the large number of women who have become involved and were living as common law wives or cohabitating with Chinese in the Chinatowns of our various cities," end quote. The New York Times. Dr. Hamilton Wright, Teddy Roosevelt's opium commissioner, thought one of the worst things about an opium epidemic was white women moving to Chinatown. Incredible. The irony of these federal maneuvers is that data show that narcotics use, opium and cocaine in particular, was on a decline in the early 20th century from a post-Civil War boom when nobody gave a fuck if people smoked opium in public. Drugs became crime so they could be taxed, and through a racist association with black, Mexican, and Chinese people. In addition to regulating registered sale, the Harrison Act prohibited physicians from prescribing addictive medicines as a treatment for addiction. In other words, you could still get opium painkillers, but you couldn't legally consume opium to treat an opium habit. Because that makes fucking sense. By the time it was passed, 46 states had cocaine regulations in place. 29 had regulations on opium already. Cannabis was still being consumed relatively openly, and with the passage of Prohibition in 1919, cannabis use would actually start being encouraged as an alternative to alcohol consumption. Hamilton Wright continued to fearmonger that narcotics gave black people superhuman powers and made them impossible to control. I'm not fucking kidding. Warning of a pandemic of defiant, superhuman, drug-crazed Negroes and Chinese people who were going to overthrow the government. And this was hammered at Congress and the public. Dr. Christopher Koch of the State Pharmacy Board of Pennsylvania testified on the record as a doctor that, quote, "Most of the attacks upon the white women of the South are the direct result of a cocaine-crazed Negro brain," end quote. In a century, weed was used to stop Negro revolts, and cocaine was regulated allegedly to prevent one. In the 1970s, heroin would be painted as a black problem to justify urban surveillance, and in the 80s and 90s, crack would be a black problem to justify and create what was mass incarceration. Seeing a trend here in drug prohibition? Maybe. Incidentally, contemporary research on the subject indicates that use of opium and cocaine was higher amongst white people, but that trend continues all the way to traffic stops in the present day. With the passage of the Harrison Act, distribution channels began to dry up in 1915, despite widespread newspaper coverage of an ongoing opiate-fueled crime wave present as late as 1918. the sudden inability to procure opium legally became supplemented, as it always is, by the creation of a black market that, as we know, was also regulated and overseen by the federal government. In 1914, the first drug raid for cannabis occurred in Sonora Town in Los Angeles, where a wagon load of cannabis was seized. California, as I said earlier, had previously passed the first poison laws targeting cannabis specifically in 1907, and by 1913, quote, extracts, tincture, or other narcotic preparations of hemp or local weed, their preparations and compounds, end quote, was a misdemeanor in the state. Despite some encouragement to use in dry states, weed laws appeared in Wyoming in 1915, Texas in 1919, Iowa in 1923, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, Arkansas, all in 1923, and then Nebraska and Louisiana in 1927, and Colorado in 1929, as prohibition began to wind down with the realization that policing alcohol was impossible. And, of course, a $300 million tab for law enforcement to prove it. America's vice institution really needed aimed at a new target now. Enter private business and Harry Anslinger. In 1930, the U.S. Department of the Treasury established the Federal Bureau of Narcotics to consolidate its Narcotics Control Board and Narcotics Division, the departments that were responsible for enforcing the Harrison Act and the subsequent Narcotic Drugs Import and Export Act, which banned the importation of opium in 1922. The first commissioner to the FBN was Harry Anslinger, son-in-law of Andrew Mellon, a staunch supporter of drug prohibition. While Mellon had helped support alcohol prohibition, he didn't actually view it as sustainable, but he did support drug regulation, along with other prominent American businessmen like William Randolph Hearst and the DuPont family. Privately funded anti-cannabis propaganda like Reefer Madness appeared in 1936. Reefer Madness portrayed a group of high school kids, kind of, who try pot and become hardened criminals and rapists, with one character committing suicide after going insane from smoking weed. The film was originally financed by a church group and called Tell Your Children before being recut for the exploitation film circuit. I actually watched Reefer Madness yesterday to prepare for this episode of the show, and every time I watch it, the thing that both entertains me about it and kind of concerns me about myself is that I don't notice anything odd about the behavior of the people who are supposed to be on drugs until they start acting like maniacs. I mean, there is sort of this insane laughter component to everything, and there's always been this weird conflation between cannabis use and like being violent, angry, and bloodlust and things of that nature that has never made any sense to me or anyone else who's ever used cannabis before. That's prevalent throughout the film that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But otherwise, it's just a bunch of kids in a room playing the piano and dancing while they make out with each other, which seems like one of the safest thing teenagers could do unsupervised, I guess. Reefer Madness is this sort of gonzo fucking... It's now viewed as a satire, but it was this church propaganda about how smoking weed would make you kill people and rape women and turn you into a terrible degenerate. And it's just a hilarious thing to look at now where they say that, you know, yes, opium is a problem and cocaine is a problem, but no one understands that weed is worse than all of them combined. It encourages jazz music and fraternizing or whatever. It's very entertaining interesting to look at now when we've got, you know, Steve Urkel advertising his own weed in High Times magazine, compared to back then, whenever there was cartoons aimed at children telling you that if you smoked a joint, you might lose your mind and have to be institutionalized. And on the subject of anti-cannabis propaganda, the 30s saw big business take a real interest in drug prohibition, cannabis in particular. The DuPont family started making their fortune, which is now estimated at $14 billion, manufacturing gunpowder. But they had aspirations of breaking into the development of synthetic fibers, an industry that was at the time dominated by hemp. Ultimately, the conflict came down to oil, really. DuPont had invented cellophane and nylon, made from chemicals found in petroleum. But hemp fiber was essentially the first plant-based plastic and provided a safer, cheaper, natural alternative. Hemp, as most potheads are quick to remind everyone, is extraordinarily versatile. It can be used for an unreal number of things. Dude, they made a fucking car out of it once. But it's also edible, and hemp oil is excellent for plastics. So DuPont began throwing financial weight behind killing the cannabis industry. And the Federal Bureau of Narcotics put muscle into the fight on a federal level. Probably famous in the conversation about cannabis prohibition, and something of a right-hand man to Harry Anslinger, was the and the FBN, was William Randolph Hearst. Businessman and politician, founder of Hearst Communications, and massive purveyor of yellow journalism, not to be confused with its other name, journalism, administrator of, at one time, the largest newspaper chain and media company in America, which he used to promulgate said yellow journalism. Real quick, if you're unfamiliar, yellow journalism is sort of slang for sensationalism and, well, lying. Yellow journalism was a precursor to tabloid journalism. We're going to cover propaganda on an episode next week, and we'll talk more about that then. Anyway, William's dad was California Senator George Hearst. Phenomenal fucking beard, for the record. And he came from old mining money. George gave William his first newspaper in 1887, the San Francisco Examiner. Must be fucking dope coming from old money. William moved to New York and used that old money to buy the New York Journal, which feuded with the New York World, owned by Joseph Pulitzer. Also, not a great guy. Newspapers are and have kinda always been owned by some of the worst people ever. I have an idea where the, I have absolutely no idea where the whole heroic truth teller thing comes from. Honestly, I mean, Deep Throat? Is that it? Is it Deep Throat? Maybe? Still, American journalism, that feels self-congratulatory to me, but, you know, whatever. After unlocking the secret that sex, crime, and violence will sell newspapers, Hearst expanded his empire to running paper companies in 30 cities, and these papers published Hearst's opinion, because he owned them, and he used them to push for war with Spain in 1898, an accusation he would later deny, and he used the papers to successfully push himself to 2 terms in the House of Representatives. And he would also run, unsuccessfully, thank God, for president in 1904 and mayor of New York in 1905 and 1909. Hearst opposed the Russian Revolution, because of course he did, also the League of Nations, because of course he did, and FDR, because, again, of course he did, and weed, as most people are aware. Hemp paper really provided an alternative to the paper milling industry, one of Hearst's major investments. to mitigate hemp's impact on wood paper, Hearst collaborated with Anslinger and the FBN to further demonize cannabis to the public and push for stricter legislation on sale and consumption. Hearst was not unlike Anslinger, a virulent racist, who hated black people and the Chinese in particular. So, guess what his papers printed? Like, all the fucking time. Exactly. Stories about non-white people on drugs, cannabis in particular, committing crimes. And this schlock had a massive readership. Hearst's print empire reached an estimated 20 million readers a day. And this massive influence on the public and his position politically led to Hearst himself co-authoring the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937. Real quick, before I get into that, you'll note that that's probably the first time you've heard me call it or say marijuana today. There's a reason for that. Anti-cannabis propaganda intentionally pushed to call weed marijuana to exaggerate its relationship to Mexican immigrants. They sought to identify the plant in Americans' minds as linked to illegal immigration, much like the government had done in the past with opium and the Chinese. It therefore wasn't a domesticated plant that had grown in literally every fucking state in the country. It was foreign, exotic, forbidden, alien, dangerous. So for me, part of decolonizing my speech is not saying marijuana, because it's just a propaganda device to play on the racial fears of white Americans. You also probably caught mention of loco weed in the California legislation from earlier. Part of the federal government, working on behalf of private business, has worked tirelessly to do is use white Americans' pre-existing racial prejudices to make race, drugs, and crime synonymous and inseparable in the American consciousness. When Anslinger testified before Congress about cannabis, he read a letter from the editor of the Daily Courier, a newspaper in Colorado. Quote, "I wish I could show you what a small marijuana cigarette can do to one of our degenerate Spanish-speaking residents, who are low mentally because of social and racial conditions." End quote. So, I just say no to marijuana. I say yes to cannabis all the time, but that's a whole other thing. Anyway, the Marijuana Tax Act. This placed a tax on all cannabis sales, but perhaps most importantly for private business, it blocked further research and study into the applications and uses of cannabis. And now, DuPont had no healthy, cheap oil alternatives, and Hearst could clear-cut trees to print jingoism, and Anslinger had justified the budget on narcotics prohibition. With the passage of the Tax Act, all untaxed cannabis sales became illegal at a federal level. The first victims of the new legislation, Samuel Caldwell and Moses Baca, were sentenced to 18 months in Leavenworth before the end of the first year. And at the same time, the Department of Agriculture was issuing tax stamps for grow farmers in the Philippines to grow hemp for fiber for the war effort against Japan. Licenses were granted for commercial hemp manufacture until 1951, in fact. Another thing that happened in 1951 was the Boggs Act. Boggs amended the previous Narcotic Drugs Import and Export Act and established mandatory minimum sentences for drug convictions. With the passage of the Boggs Act, a first offense conviction for cannabis possession now carried a minimum sentence of 2 to 10 years and a maximum fine of $20,000. Boggs was signed by Harry Truman in November of 1951. By January 4th of 1952, 500 people were arrested and incarcerated. Guaranteed labor for the burgeoning carceral state, and guaranteed money in fines. Decades of playing to racial animus and pushing funds to enact legislation finally put slavery right back where it had been. The fields were just indoors and less unsightly. This way, in a way, the federal government spent roughly a century nationalizing the slave trade. And a component of mandatory sentencing is an escalation in punitive measures, more time and bigger fines, basically, for repeat offenders. So there was now a vested interest in recidivism. And to this end, in 1952, the federal government implemented three strikes laws, or habitual offender laws. With three strikes laws, people receiving their third conviction receive an automatic life sentence. To date, 28 states still hold some form of three-strike legislation, despite the idea of, quote, persistent offender laws being ruled unconstitutional in 2010. With mandatory sentencing, the proportion of black offenders grew from less than 10% to over 28%. By 2010, that had risen to 28.5%. A system of over-policing, with a scale-up system for punitive measures, with mandatory life sentencing on a third conviction. If you've wondered how we ended up with almost 8 million people in prison and a third of the adult population with criminal records, I submit to you that the answer is intentionally. In order to set an international tone, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics set up offices in France, Italy, Turkey, Beirut, and Thailand to monitor opium traffic, you know, not being overseen by the CIA. See, by policing drugs internationally, the federal government also enables itself to, following suit from Klaus Barbie and the Fiancés of Death in Bolivia, use the military and the government to eliminate competition and position state-sponsored narcos at the top of the food chain in a black market created by U.S. drug prohibition. Something else that grew in prominence at this time was progression hypothesis, more commonly known as gateway drug theory. The gateway drug theory suggests that the use of one psychoactive substance will necessarily lead to the use of other, usually more potent psychoactive substances. Further study has all but disproven a causal link to the use of different drugs. One of the early proponents of the gateway drug theory, Robert DuPont of the DuPont Company. And cannabis was singled out in particular as a stepping stone to opium and cocaine. I want to say these people miss out that uppers and downers usually appeal to different kinds of people, but these are the people who say that weed inspired bloodlust and gave you superpowers, so there was a lot about drugs lost in translation. Mostly on purpose, I think. Studies indicate the vast majority of people who use cannabis don't actually use any other drugs, opium and cocaine in particular. But then, at the time, studying it was illegal, so it isn't like there was much of a dissenting opinion on the subject. I mean, Fiorella LaGuardia, the last New York mayor worth a shit, opposed cannabis prohibition, vocally. If only he could see New York now. It's kind of a shame, really. Harry Anslinger retired from the FBN in 1962, finally setting down his sword after a career destroying the lives of millions of people. criticism that the Bureau and the drug policy frequently violated the Fourth Amendment on search and seizure abounded, of course, and continue to this day. In 1971, Congress under the Nixon administration passed the Controlled Substances Act, which further regulated the possession, use, manufacture, and distribution of certain substances. The act also implemented legislation for the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, an international treaty that controlled cultivation, transport, supply, and trade via a system of licenses internationally. The treaty has been since ratified in 186 countries and was followed swiftly by the Convention on Psychotropic Substances, which regulated LSD and MDMA. The Controlled Substances Act domestically set up the schedule system, like we talked about on Wednesday, something determined collaboratively between the FDA and the DEA, which the act also created. From the Pure Food and Drug Act to the Controlled Substances Act, a period of about 60 years, the federal government passed over 200 pieces of legislation aimed directly or indirectly at drugs. And the CSA bound all of them together and greatly increased the overall scope of the federal government's ability to police drugs at a state level. The act created the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, also known as the Schaefer Commission, headed by Raymond P. Schaefer. The purpose of the commission was to assess cannabis abuse and addiction in the United States. Their first presentation of findings to Congress became the first call for decriminalization. In other words, the first actual study into cannabis use, cannabis abuse, and penalization determined that the anti-cannabis measures were too harsh and the punitive measures were too severe. That was 52 years ago, by the way. As a concession, amendments to the CSA were made to explore rehabilitation channels. Meanwhile, the DEA became a front-runner in the domestic policing of what was now fully illegal drug trading. It does split jurisdiction with the FBI, Border Control, and Customs and Immigration. The act, in addition to creating the DEA, created something called ODAIL, the Office of Drug Abuse Law Enforcement, which supplemented the DEA through the Justice Department. ODAIL policed drug users and tried to compel people into federal rehabilitation programs. It only lasted a year and was swiftly absorbed into the DEA, which became the ground troops in Nixon's war on drugs. The DEA has an intelligence unit that operates collaboratively with the CIA and the National Intelligence Director, actually, probably so as to not arrest the wrong people. The DEA has also received wide criticism for seizing money in raids more often than actual drugs, almost like they're criminals and the whole thing is a farce or something. By 2018... the DEA's annual budget was $2.8 billion, split between foreign and domestic operations. It seizes an estimated $65 billion in product a year. And look, that may sound impressive, but it's actually less than 1% of the distributed product domestically. So they're not actually efficient at drug regulation or policing at all. And of course, no data exists for how much of that product ends up back on the street being sold by law enforcement. I'd venture to say not all, but not less than most. The 70s saw the war on drugs kick into high gear. And the casualties were high. By 1980... the number of, I didn't even plan that to be a play on words, but yeah, what are you going to do? The number of arrests for drugs had risen by 126%, accounting for nearly 30% of black incarceration. One in five black Americans would be incarcerated for drug offenses, and 1.5 million Americans a year would be arrested for drug-related crimes. And of course, the propaganda fucking continued. Hearst's yellow journalism would be supplemented by a litany of ridiculous fake accounts of the hazards of drug use. We talked about Reefer Madness from the 30s, and in 1971, Beatrice Sparks released Go Ask Alice. Totally not a Jefferson Airplane reference to Through the Looking Glass or anything. A definitely real journal by a definitely real 15-year-old girl. Go Ask Alice is written in a manuscript style, sort of chronicling a 15-year-old girl named Anonymous, pretty sure that's Greek, and her descent into debauchery and madness from smoking pot. This is so fantastic, and we've done so much discussion about legislative minutiae that I feel like we should take a minute to talk about Go Ask Alice. So the story, I'm sorry, the journal entries, let's be honest, take place between 1968 and 1969. And they're about a 15-year-old girl who starts out, you know, with the basic things such as crushes, weight loss, being popular, not getting along with her parents. And the dates and locations that are mentioned place its events as between California, Colorado, Oregon, and New York City. She moves around a lot. And the two towns in which her family lives during the story aren't specifically identified. They're just described as being college towns. And part of that is because the main character, Anonymous, again, her father is a college professor, and he accepts a dean position at a new school, which means the family has to move. And the main character has a lot of trouble adjusting to the new school, but she becomes best friends with a girl named Beth. And when Beth leaves for summer camp, the main character returns to her hometown to stay with her grandparents. She meets an old friend from school who invites her to a party. There, glasses of cola, some of which are laced with LSD, are served to all of the people at the party. And Anonymous unwittingly ingests LSD and has a seriously intense trip. And one of my favorite lines in the book is, "Last night I tried LSD, it was pretty good, but I can't wait to try pot." You know, the way you usually escalate in drug use. So anyway, she trips and then realizes that she has a good time at the party and starts experimenting with more drugs, trips and loses her virginity, goes through a pregnancy scare, and when she tells her grandparents that she thinks she might be pregnant, her grandfather has a heart attack. So she becomes overwhelmed and starts taking sleeping pills that she's stealing from her grandparents, and then gets her doctor to prescribe her sleeping pills whenever she moves back home. Her friend Beth won't hang out with her anymore because, you know, she's a druggie now. And the main character meets this new hip girl named Chris, right? And they do drugs together, and they date college guys whose names are Richie and Ted. And why the fuck you would ever date someone named Ted is beyond me, but, you know, the story's made up. These guys deal drugs and persuade the two girls to help them deal drugs to high school kids. Sound familiar? When the girls walk in on Richie and Ted stoned having sex with each other, they realize that their boyfriends are gay and just using them to make money. The girls report Richie and Ted to the police and run away to San Francisco. Chris starts working at a boutique with a glamorous older woman named Sheila, who invites both girls to a whole bunch of parties where they resume taking drugs. One night, Sheila and her boyfriend introduce the girls to heroin and then rape them while they're passed out. The girls then move to Berkeley and open a jewelry store with what money, I'm not sure. They get tired of it, though, and then move back home for Christmas. Once they're home, the main character, Anonymous, realizes that she's got a serious drug problem and that she can't get along with her parents anymore because she's stoned all the time. She tries to kick, and that's her word, by the way, kick, but she can't, so she gets arrested and ends up on probation, runs away from home, and starts hitchhiking. They meet a little girl named Doris who's been molested several times, who's also a hitchhiker. They use drugs with her. They become sex workers. They're homeless at one point. She meets a priest who tries to reunite her with her family. And eventually she does acid and has serious brain damage and ends up in a psychiatric hospital where she becomes friends with a child prostitute. And that is the story. So Go Ask Alice is this wildly fake story invented by this woman. And I was actually having a conversation with someone the other day about this tradition, right? Because if you remember back to, or you've listened to, our episode on the Satanic Panic, for example, or some of the things, you know, if you grew up around like charismatic Christians, they have this really strange way of storytelling in which they need to hype up the debauchery of their previous life before they found God or kicked drugs, or in some cases is a cautionary tale situation. You know, we talked about Mike Wernke whenever we did the Satanic Panic thing, and this was a guy who claimed to have, from after his first joint, become a leader of a satanic cult that had a harem in an apartment paid for by an international heroin trafficking ring that was run by thousands of satanic people who kidnapped and sold children and all these other things. And all of this supposedly happened in a 9-month period between whenever it started college and enlisted in the Navy. And this is a thing that happens a lot in, for some reason, in the weird, like, moral panic sphere of entertainment. There's these lurid accounts of, oh, and I did acid, and then I had my first joint, and then after my first joint, the next thing I knew, I was friends with a child prostitute in a mental institution. What? I've been doing drugs for 26 years, and I can't say that I ever ended up any, well, maybe, maybe not. Anyway, that's entirely besides the point. The point is that this didn't fucking happen. And it was one of many examples of attempts by private business funding individuals like Ms. Sparks here to demonize drug use to the general public, to make it easier to continue to police drugs, which again is this dual-headed snake where you can pump things into the community and then just use that, the presence of that substance in the community, to justify policing and surveilling the community, and then funnel those people into an exploitable workforce for private business, which then gives you money. It's just a big circle of corporate financing and bullshit at the end of the day. In 1986, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act was passed by Ronald Reagan. This act transformed federal supervised release, parole, basically, into a punitive system. And it amended the previous mandatory minimum sentence legislation pertaining to cannabis. It also authorized the eradication of cannabis and poppy fields as adjacent to illicit drug trafficking, and was the first of many new pieces of legislation passed by the Reagan administration to go after crack cocaine. We talked about this a little bit on Monday and Wednesday. The country was in the midst of a heightened moral panic over crack and cocaine use, and the federal government was primed and fairly competing with itself to enact more and more severe punitive actions against drug users. the Anti-Drug Abuse Act also consisted of a Money Laundering Control Act aimed at criminalizing money laundering for the first time in the country's history and giving more levity to the federal government to, well, rob people. That's all civil asset forfeiture is. It's just theft, usually via armed robbery or what they call a police raid. The crack house law, as they called it, permitted seizure and resale of homes in which drug crime took place. This act further increased black incarceration by 49%, and new laws enacting stricter punishments for crack and weed, black offenders served sentences between 11 and 28% longer. The person who oversees this system has come to be referred to as a drug czar, which is just fucking Freudian. And these new acts, like with civil asset forfeiture, also establish a system of collateral criminal damages, which is unlike any other type of American crime. Being arrested for drugs really makes everything you own fair game for the government to just take and resell for profit. But also, there are additional tangential consequences, as with the 1990 Solomon-Lautenberg Amendment, which created pathways for and urged states to suspend the driver's licenses of people who commit drug offenses. States that refused to comply were penalized with reduced federal funding for highways, 5% in the first year and 10% every year after that. And these punitive measures against your driver's license, having your driver's license suspended, was irrespective of whether a vehicle was involved in the arrest or not. The slogan, quote, "Smoke a joint, lose your license," became the tag for the laws passed under the amendment, which happened in California, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Indiana, Delaware, Georgia, Massachusetts, Iowa, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Texas, Virginia, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, and Alaska. After years of basically unanimous criticism, as of 2021, the laws only remain active in Florida, Alabama, and Alaska. The largest criticism is that suspending people's licenses in unrelated circumstances makes no fucking sense. But it also had a profoundly negative impact on employment. Some 42% of those affected lost their jobs, and 45% of those were unable to get new ones. Also, some 75% of those people whose licenses were suspended just kept fucking driving anyway, eventually facing harder punishments if caught driving with suspended licenses. And as always, those affected were disproportionately black. 64%. There's a loophole, of course. The suspension could be lifted if you paid a fine of $275. You know, like extortion. The 80s and 90s saw significant increase outside of the counterculture sphere for legalization. In 1993, United States Surgeon General Minnie Lee Jones, the first black surgeon general and second woman and second person of color to serve in the role, began to call for drug legalization. She also supported contraceptive distribution in schools and masturbation as an alternative to teen sex. Progressive for the time, especially. Minnie Lee, aka Minnie Jocelyn Elders, drew criticism for her position that legalizing drugs would decrease crime rates, and that the idea should be studied in depth. Funny how that was a controversial opinion and not just a fucking obvious fact. Curiously, or not, she was forced to resign after her son Kevin was arrested for trying to sell cocaine to undercover federal agents. A thing that I'm sure wasn't a lie at all. Kevin was subsequently sentenced to 10 years in prison and denied appeal after alleging federal entrapment. You can do with that information what you'd like. Lee's words and the cost that she paid for them brought attention to reality. The war on drugs is about policing, silencing, and exploitation, not justice or morality, and it disproportionately affects black and brown people. And challenges to its efficacy would continue to mount until in 2009, the Obama administration officially opted to stop using the phrase war on drugs in favor of exploring rehabilitation and treatment alternatives. And shortly thereafter, we began to see debates at a state level about medicinal cannabis. I mean, dispensaries of medical cannabis had quietly begun to appear in San Francisco in 1991. Support from physicians allowed decriminalization pushes in some more willing states like California, which opened up the sale of cannabis to AIDS patients via the San Francisco Cannabis Buyers Club and several other groups like the Woman's Alliance for Medical Marijuana in Santa Cruz and the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative, which was founded in 1995. In 1996, California passed compassionate use acts in several cities after the passage of Proposition 215, the Compassionate Use Act. On November 6th, 2012, my birthday, Colorado and Washington became the first two states to legalize cannabis, and the following year, the Obama administration issued the Cole Memorandum, stating the federal government wouldn't enforce cannabis prohibition in legalized states. Prohibition in decriminalized states continues, of course, and the ATF has raided medical operations in dispensaries many times. Since 2012, Alaska, D.C., Oregon, California, Massachusetts, Nevada, Maine, Vermont, Michigan, Illinois, Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, New York, New Mexico, Connecticut, Virginia, Rhode Island, Missouri, and Maryland have opted for legalization, and in 2020, Oregon opted to just legalize all other previously illegal drugs. And of course, these are steps in the right direction, I think, but you have to discuss, in the wake of the federal government, sort of, and state governments everywhere recognizing the benefits in taxing drug use as opposed to taxing the prohibition of drugs through prison labor, as private prisons are sort of being outmoded because everyone recognizes that they're not really helping anybody but corporations. As all of that sort of taking place, you have all of these moneyed individuals who are like 98 to 99% white getting licenses from the government to sell cannabis, while you have an outsized black prison population whose records aren't being wiped in most states. You know, if you're going to accept that, hey, the war on drugs was just a really bad idea by a whole bunch of racist businessmen, and we should probably just abandon this in favor of alternative options, then you need to do something about the victims of the war on drugs who have records that prevent them from getting adequate employment or are still in some cases serving sentences in prison based on three strike laws. Or, there's a lot you need to do beyond just saying this thing that we made illegal is legal now. There's steps in relationship to harm reduction that need to be explored as well. You know, we still have a national stigma about the racialization of a lot of drugs and drug culture. And of course, at the root of all of that is how most Americans think about crime. And what I think you can sort of conclude from the last three episodes of this show is that crime is, in fact, propaganda most of the time. And when it is real, the state's the one doing it. So we really have to apply a decolonial lens to how we interpret and reckon with all of this stuff, because there was years and years and years, over a century in the case of drugs in particular, but several centuries in relationship to crime, and understand that the state and private business, which are, you know, thoroughly intertwined at the hip, have had a vested interest in making the average American think of crime as something non-white people do to white people, or that affects white people, and that you need cops and laws in between the two groups so that never the twain shall meet. And all evidence points to the fact that that's bullshit, and those cops and those laws don't actually do what they're telling you they do at all. Cops are terrorist organizations. The CIA is a crime syndicate. The federal government is an extortion racket run by businessmen funded by human misery in underdeveloped countries. And that's, I guess, the thesis statement of our first week back in season four. That's today's episode. I hope you enjoyed and learned something. There was just so many laws to read, and as a person who doesn't think laws are real unless I decide that they are, it was a lot of reading imagine. It was a lot of reading fairy tales, really, because, I don't know, federal legislation about drugs might as well be Cinderella as far as I'm concerned. But, fucking A, that's the first week back. We did it, again, I say. And you know, I hope that, I guess I already said, I hope you enjoy this. I told you I got high before I did this. It's not my fault. It is. I'm just choosing not to take responsibility for it. Anyway, we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. Next week we're going to discuss the, surveillance state and Panopticon on Monday. We're going to talk about the history of American censorship and sort of blacklisting and those kinds of things. And I don't actually remember what the third thing for next week is, but I know that's Monday and Wednesday. So you have that to look forward to coming up in the very near future, coming at you, if you will. And, you know, in the meantime, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you Hepcats on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it, Daddy-O. Daddy-O? Really, Mox? You know, this is one of those things, right, where like, I always think maybe I should try a new thing because maybe the tags are getting dated because I've been doing the same tags since roughly the pilot season of the show, so maybe I should try something else, right? Like, don't, you know, overstay your welcome on the tags, right? But every time I try a little flourish on them, I feel like it sounds terrible. So, I don't know, maybe if it ain't broke, don't fix it is the adage that I should be going with. I don't know, but no more Daddy-O. That was a one-off. That didn't feel right to me at all. I apologize to all of you. I'm going to take that again from the top. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
Which brings me another point. We should all be boycotting Disney products, Disney movies, Disney television, Disney everything. They're brainwashing your children. Big time. As Walt Disney died, there is supposed to be something coming.
I'm finished.